So what then is the criteria for getting into heaven? If we knew the criteria, we would know better how to live in the here and the now, what's important in this life that gains us access to the life after. And every now and then we tell some stories among us, lighter kinds of stories, you know, people that get to meet St. Peter at the gate, a Mennonite, a Baptist, a Lutheran. They get there and they follow the instructions. We laugh a little bit. We scratch our heads because it's an incomplete answer to the criteria of what takes us across the threshold into eternity. Maybe that's a little bit like the parables that Jesus tells, especially the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. These parables are not literal stories, especially when it comes to the details of the afterlife, but instead these stories serve as signposts, as glimpses of what's important in the reign of God in the world today, and how we can be paying attention to those signposts. The parables, and in this parable, the characters are rather clear, contrasting each other. A rich man, in this case, feasting on gourmet food and fine wine, not just once a month, not just on vacation, not just on the weekends. The parable says every day, conspicuous consumption. He's living the good life, and he dresses the part so that everyone else can see. Purple and fine linens, imported fabrics, describing a wealthy person, a king, a royal member of the ruling caste, all those wealthy enough to afford that kind of attire. And in contrast to this nameless rich man, we have Lazarus, the only character in the parables that Jesus tells that actually has a name, Lazarus, which means the one God helps. Lazarus is poor. In fact, Lazarus is sickly poor. Instead of being clothed and covered with fine linens, he's clothed with something else. He's covered with sores. And instead of feasting every day, Lazarus longs for the crumbs that fall from the rich man's table. Instead of a home to go into, he sits outside the border wall, the gate out there, separated by the gate or the fence that keeps insiders and outsiders apart from each other. And yet, in some ways, they share some characteristics. They both want to be seen by others, right? The rich man wants to be seen by others as wealthy and dresses the part, and the poor man wants to be seen by Lazarus. Or the poor man, Lazarus, wants to be seen by the rich man for help and assistance. And it's very clear that poor Lazarus sees the rich man, but the question in the parable is, does the rich man see Lazarus? I think about this story when I get off the train at Jefferson Station and I walk up to the street and make my way outside. Just outside the staircase, sometimes even inside the staircase, are homeless people that are sitting there, standing there, beggars with a sign wanting money. I see them and I turn away. I don't really want to see them. I really don't want to help them. Their problems, their sickness is so great that a few of my dollars can't possibly help in any way. And so I'm on my way. I soon forget that they're there until the next time I see them, when I barely look. You see, this is not just a first century story. It's as contemporary as the contrast in our world today. Someone has said, Luke has clarity about disparity in his gospel and throughout his gospel. There's haves and there's have-nots in our world, and the statistics are incredibly sobering. 80% of the people in our world today live on $10 a day or less. 80% of the world lives on $10 a day or less. Half of the world's population lives on less than $2.50 a day, and the really extreme poor of 20% of the population in the world live on less than $1.25 a day. The World Food Program says the poor are hungry and their hunger traps them in their poverty. In other words, hunger simply paralyzes them from finding another way out. It makes them sick. Hunger is the leading cause of death in our world. More than all the other diseases combined together, hunger is the disease that is killing more people. So where do we fit if most of the world, 80% of the world, lives on $10 a day or less? There's a website called globalrichlist.com. You can go there after church today, or maybe, well, no, don't do it now. On the homepage, they say, if you didn't make it on the list of the wealthiest in the world, don't worry, we can help find your place in the world of wealth. Just plug in your income and we'll calculate your place in the world's wealthiest. And so I took the annual average income in Montgomery County. That's $87,000 a year, the average annual household income in Montgomery County. And I plugged $87,000 into their calculator, and then next it said, congratulations, you are 1/10 of the top 1% in the world. That makes you, the number, 5,778,155th richest person in the world. 5 million in a world of, well, what is it, 9 billion. Today, when we compare ourselves to the population of the world, we know we're rich. Both our annual income, the things we enjoy, the things we take for granted, like housing, 3 meals a day, fresh water, clothing. But many of us don't feel that rich, do we? In fact, all of us know too well the real struggle, the stressful struggle, worry over finances sometimes, the struggles of strain and stress of trying to get ahead. Not only does this parable call to our minds the global gap in wealth, but also the growing wealth disparity in our own country between rich and poor. In the last 30 years, the average median household income has actually declined. We know some of these statistics firsthand, but the average household income has declined from a median income of about $87,000 to below $80,000 to $78,000 in the last 30 years, which explains why some of us really don't feel that rich, what with debts of various kinds and health insurance and medical expenses, the concerns about retirement income. We don't feel rich, while the top 1% in our country, their income has doubled from 10 million to 25 million. And so that's the disparity we live with in our own country. And this parable illustrates how we're all looking up the ladder, like poor Lazarus looking up at the rich man. We all look up and we see those who have more, and we think of ourselves as poor. Well, whether the rich man ever saw the poor man outside his gate during his life, we don't know. But we do know one thing in the parable, that in the afterlife, the rich man does see poor Lazarus in the afterlife. And maybe here is where we can't exactly take this parable for its literal description of what it's actually like, but let's go with the parable this morning. And this is what's downright shocking, if not disturbing, for us when we read this parable. What is it that Jesus is trying to do with this troubling story? And maybe Jesus is just trying to get us angry this morning and upset. I mean, doesn't it bother anyone that this giant reversal takes place in the afterlife? I mean, this parable gets to me in a way that the other teachings of Jesus on wealth don't quite sink in. But this parable sinks in. I mean, is Jesus really saying the poor of the world automatically get rewarded with a spot next to Abraham, while the rich automatically go in that place of torment called Hades? Are we really saying that those outside Jefferson Station who take my several dollars and loose change to the state store, are they really elevated to eternal bliss in the afterlife while folks like me end up in torment? Does a rich man end up in Hades simply because he's rich? It's a harsh parable. I guess you could say we should have seen it coming. While some parts of the Bible actually seem to support a prosperity gospel where, you know, God blesses those who are good with wealth, most of the Bible isn't that way, and Jesus certainly critiques that. And Luke really critiques that point of view in these verses and parables on wealth disparity and God's kind of preferential treatment for the poor that we see throughout the ministry of Jesus. We should have seen this parable coming. Jesus changes the narrative. We've heard these stories before, and Luke, being the inspired master teacher, puts it all together so succinctly in his gospel. At the beginning of his gospel, we have Mary singing of this giant reversal that's already taking place in the birth and the coming of Jesus. That Mary sings about this God who brings the powerful down from their thrones and lifts up the lowly, who fills the hungry with good things and sends the rich away empty-handed. Jesus comes on the scene, and his first sermon is taken from the book of Isaiah, chapter 61, where he talks about good news for the poor. And then Luke's version of the Beatitudes is in chapter 6, where it's not spiritualized as the poor in spirit, it's just about the poor. And not about those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, it's just about the hungry. Where Jesus says, blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you will be filled. And then goes on to say, woe to you who are rich, woe to you who are laughing now, woe to you who are full now, for you will be hungry. We've heard these sayings before in Luke's gospel. It's just that we never thought it would end up this way. And then along the way, Jesus tells these stories, the rich farmer, and how hard it is for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven, and tells about this banquet feast where the rich can't come, and so who comes but the poor and the blind, the lame, the crippled? And just before this, Jesus says you can't serve two masters. As Clarence Jordan says, it doesn't say you shouldn't serve two masters, God and wealth. No, it says you can't. We've heard these parables and sayings before, especially this parable now, where the rich man who enjoyed the finer things in life, now suffering for eternity, it's really upsetting. It reminds us we really don't know what poverty feels like. Most of us don't know what it's like to suffer. We take our health for granted, although until we're sick, and then we know. As long as we have income and bank accounts, we really don't know quite what it's like to struggle, although we know a little bit. Maybe that's why we keep the poor at a distance. We keep ourselves separated in categories. The only place we see poverty is on our TV screen, or maybe outside Jefferson Station, or those in other countries. Our fences really do keep us apart from hearing the cries of the poor. Our gated communities protect us not only from those who might come and take our stuff, but they keep us from seeing the people on the other side, from actually seeing our neighbors who live outside our gate. And a really harsh message of this parable is that the gates, the fences in this life, the walls that we construct in this life to avoid the poor can be eternally fixed. That great chasm that can't be crossed. The gate in life become permanent in the afterlife. And sadly, the rich man hasn't really learned anything now in eternity, because The rich man still expects the poor man, Lazarus, to do his bidding, to be a slave, to be a servant, to go get him some water to quench his burning tongue, and to go tell his brothers that, well, the afterlife is different. And while we want to try with all of our human power to say, well, it's really about grace, right? Salvation, eternity is really about the God of mercy. We squirm with all our might to recall that verse that with God all things are possible. But then we remember that in Matthew's gospel, we have that end time parable about judgment by our works. When did we see you hungry or thirsty or in prison? Oh, when you saw and did it to the least of these. We hold in tension, we do, as God's people. We're saved by grace and judged by our works. And there's a little bit of hopelessness in this parable, because those boundaries that in life are kind of forgotten about, in eternity are fixed, and we can't do anything about it. That human carelessness and not seeing in this life can have consequences in the next life. And it feels rather pessimistic, discouraging. In verse 14, just before this parable that Jesus tells, Luke adds this interesting comment that the Pharisees were lovers of money. The Pharisees, they heard all this. They were lovers of money and they ridiculed Jesus. Jesus is telling this parable to the Pharisees who were focused on their wealth, that their journey with wealth can catch up with them. The rich man, now aware of his eternal consequences, pleads, wants to intercede for his family before it's too late. Can't someone go back? Can't someone turn them around? Well, no, Jesus says, they have Moses and the prophets. Those Pharisees have the law and the prophets. It wouldn't even help if someone would rise from the dead. What difference would it make that Jesus is alive almost? We can see and read into this parable. And so the parable serves as a warning tale, a kind of, as some scholars say, as a climax to Luke's theology of economic justice, of what is his perspective on wealth anyways. And it's this grand reversal that's coming that, well, maybe should prepare us. So as we hear this parable this morning, as we think about our own lives, maybe we're not the rich man after all. And we're probably not poor Lazarus after all, but maybe we're just siblings of some rich guy. We're the daughters and sons of some nameless rich guy that still have a chance, that still have an opportunity, that still have life and breath, who can receive the gift of grace from God and the opportunities that we're confronted with every day. Opportunities to see those on the other side of our gates and fences and border walls, who can see those that we really try to look away from in this life. This parable, I think, reminds us that our stories can turn before it's too late. Oxfam estimates that it would only take about $60 billion annually to end extreme global poverty. And they go on to say that's less than a quarter of the income of the top 100 richest billion people in the world, the richest billionaires in the world, 100 of the topest of the top richest people in the world can end poverty with just a quarter of their income. There's still hope for our world. Thanks to God and God's grace and our witness, our action, we can respond in meaningful ways. David Brooks writes a book earlier this year, The Second Mountain, and he talks about the fact that most people in our society go through life climbing the first mountain of success. They think a meaningful life is found in gourmet food, expensive wine, exotic vacations, a satisfying career, a good-paying job, and they get to the top of that mountain, they scratch their head and say, well, it's not not really like that after all. It really didn't bring us much happiness. And so they go on and find joy in that second mountain, in that second journey, where they find a mission, a vision for living in light of others. It's a new journey that moves from self-centeredness to other-centeredness. They see people more than things. Sounds like the good news of Jesus to turn us around to what's important in life, some of the criteria of eternity that make a difference in our lives today. On that globalrichlist.com that invites us to kind of playfully see our place in the world's scheme of wealth, then invites us to go and make a donation to global poverty, to try to make a difference in the world, to just think about giving maybe 1 hour of work, like $50, to make a difference in somebody's life. Isn't that what we are to focus on? Because here we are, we who are siblings of some rich guy have inherited much, people of privilege. That's the language of this parable, the siblings of the rich man. How then should we live? How then should we live? As one commentator said, think about it, friends. Think about the gates of our community, the fences, the border walls. Our indifference is a gate to and from heaven. Our indifference is a gate to and from heaven. Amen.